why we call this one Gay Jewish Mafia Takes Over. Like,
because it's the introductory one, and it's linked. We're talking about Macron.
Macron is accused by
Hello and welcome to Alpha Bunga Bunga. It's a politics podcast. I'm George Hoare and I tweet at POLWEQ. Don't know how to pronounce it. Also, today we have two other humans speaking who are.
I'm Philip Cunliffe. I tweet at the Philippics.
I'm Alex Hercule and I tweet at Alex double underscore 1789.
So today we're going to be mainly talking about the French presidential election. So the first round will be this coming Sunday on the 23rd. The polls are looking very tight, increasingly tight between the four main candidates. So we've got a lot to talk about and dissect there. But before we talk about the French election, Alex, what's been grinding your gears this week?
You know, you kind of, you guys might have felt this, you know, kind of growing up slightly envying previous generations who had
totally,
lots of things,
man. Like,
to go.
I particularly envied the people who grew up in the 1980s.
Those specifically. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, they had shit going on. They had things to discuss. But I know we've got it all and more now. And I'm not just talking about, you know, smartphones and Twitter.com. I'm talking about, you know, paranoia over impending world war, tectonic plates shifting, all this stuff. It's like too much to keep up with. It's great. I fucking love it, like living today.
But I'm also quite jealous of people who are coming to political age now, because it was so dull to study and think and talk about politics in the early noughties.
Absolutely.
It was like, you've got to be sociopathic to join the Labour Party, for example, in the early noughties. But now there's actually things going on. So, yeah. We're like the forgotten men of history.
People who are in their like early 30s now, mid-30s, something like that, we're the most damned generation in history, probably.
Oh.
Like, we've had the most stultifying, uninspiring political education that the world has ever offered a generation, like in modernity or whatever. It's really bad. Like, we're damned.
It's, yeah, particularly.
It's terrible. Men. I mean, it's worse. Yeah, no, it's exactly. It's particularly worse for white middle class men. They're the worst, the most damned generation of like recent history, for sure.
We've had no advantages.
Yeah,
it's quite sad.
I mean, it's like that Ben Folds Five song. You know, you all don't know what it's like being male, middle class, and white.
I don't know what it's like.
No comment. No comment. I have nothing. Nothing.
So that's what you've been thinking about, Alex, is how you're a forgotten man of history.
Well, okay, so there's that. And then also, relatedly, is this claim, I mean, this is, I don't even know why I'm citing Quartz, because it's a terrible outlet. But anyway, the idea that we live in a hold my beer world now. Do you see this? Hold my beer.
Yeah, I did.
You know the fucking hold my beer meme? No, we don't live in a hold my beer world. We live in a post-peak hold my beer meme world now. That's what we live in. It's just fucking awful. And anyway, I mean, it's kind of, I guess, the idea that we live in this idea of like contemporary absurdism, like this one-upmanship of absolute fuckery, which the world presents us daily. But anyway, I coined a term for this, which was hyper-surreality, a while ago, and no one's taken up the hashtag, and instead you've got this hold my beer meme, which is a lot worse. So,
sorry, Alex. Yeah. The hold my beer, I mean, I don't know why your hashtag isn't taking off compared to like a better hashtag. But
so what is the hold my beer world for listeners who don't know, and also I don't know. I mean,
how can you not know the hold my beer meme?
Well, I've seen it, but I never really got it. It's like hold a beer.
I don't know if a meme can be explained like in conversation.
But we're gonna try. So the thing is
we're gonna try.
The thing is that, you know, like fucking Trump threatens North Korea, North Korea threatens back, and then someone does something even crazier. Like what's happened in the media this week? Like what's happened in the world?
So it could be anything from like, I don't know, World War III to Brexit or something.
Sean Spicer denying the Holocaust.
Yeah, like that, yeah. You know, like everything from like a petty gaffe by some kind of low rent White House salesman to major kind of international events, you can turn into some ridiculous hold my beer meme.
I think we've successfully turned this really awful meme into something even more boring. So, well done.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's the first.
Isn't that the point of this podcast?
Yeah.
To make memes really boring.
Yeah. Take kind of international affairs and world wars potentially and just reduce them to dry as bone political analysis.
It's a long noble line. It's a long noble line of boring dudes explaining the joke.
boring white men explaining the joke.
Exactly. Next week on mansplaining.
So Phil, what have you been?
What am I thinking about? I've been thinking, I suppose, about progress memes, I guess.
So when you say progress memes, do you have any specifically in mind?
Well, so there's this kind of typical Vox or humanprogress.com style response to any particular event or to the general kind of propaganda that they disseminate. So you think terrorist attacks are tremendously terrible right now. But if we plot this on a graph, then you'll see that 50 years ago, so many more people were living on $3 a day, or so many more people were suffering violent terrorism. Or if you plot it against going back 50 centuries or something ridiculous like that, then you'll see that, in fact, actually, things are so much better now. People live longer, healthier, happier lives. So I've been thinking about progress memes like that, which is that kind of... kind of pop data journalism that has become current.
Right, so it's like, yeah, you know, you're dying of cancer, but you know, you should feel better because a lot of other people are not dying of malaria as they used to.
Yeah, that kind of thing. But also, I mean, it's kind of political effect is, I think, it's the effect of your grandparent telling you the kind of utterly boring and ultimately disingenuous thing. Oh, you know, you should be grateful because things are better for you than they were in my day.
It's your it's technocratic granddad on Twitter. That's what it is.
Perfect. Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is.
Okay, maybe let's move things on. Do we want to talk about France, or do we want to talk about what I've been finding interesting this week in the news?
I think we want to talk about France.
We want to talk about France because it's much more interesting than what you find interesting in the news, George. So.
Well, actually, what I've been finding interesting in the news this week...
We wanted to talk about France.
Is the French president. there you go. So I guess the first question that I had for the two of you is, why is this interesting? Why should we talk about this? Because this is going to be the first thing that we talk about, the first main section on the first podcast that we have. So this is really us nailing our colour to the mast and saying this is what we find interesting about modern politics. So if somebody listening to it finds it boring, then why bother listening to the rest of the whole thing?
It's remarkable, I think, because so you've had two significant upsets at the world level, obviously Brexit and then the Trump presidency. And it seemed to be that you had the Dutch kind of elections in the meantime, in which the kind of centre-right / right-wing party managed to hold on in the face of a populist insurgency. But the unexpected character, everyone expected that it would be the centre-left / centrist liberal candidate, Emmanuel Macron, against Marine Le Pen, the far-right candidate. But nobody expected that Fillon, I think, would hold on, so the kind of Catholic centre-right / right-wing candidate would hold on so significantly, and obviously, much more importantly, that the far-left candidate would manage to break through and sustain into being a credible figure into the first round. And so now, like as Alex mentioned, it's into the margin of error. It genuinely is an open contest.
Right, and this is the thing. What you've got now, not just with Marine Le Pen, but also the surge of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, is people like The Economist absolutely shitting their pants over a possibility of a runoff between the hard left and the hard right, raising the prospect of a situation where the next president of France would definitely be very skeptical of the EU, possibly, depending on how you look at Le Pen versus Mélenchon, in favor of withdrawing from the euro and leading to the possible collapse of the EU, as well as being much more protectionist on trade and so on. This is kind of
let's roll back a bit. So I think it's interesting because I think the one thing, and I don't mean to interrupt, but like I think one thing that's clear is that the I don't think people have genuinely absorbed, because so there's obviously the first and the second round, and I think all the polls suggest that Macron wins in all of, so if Macron is in the second round, he wins all of the votes. And Mélenchon wins against Le Pen in the second round. But I don't think anybody is really, in the same way that even though people knew the polls were tight in the run-up to Brexit, nobody actually thought it would happen. Nobody kind of began to factor in what the world might look like if Brexit actually happened. And I think a similar thing is going on with this election. Everybody accepts that it's tight, but nobody is willing to envisage and the actuality, because I mean, if Marine Le Pen wins, or even if Mélenchon wins, it's tremendously destabilizing to the European Union, and through that to the entire global economy and global power structure, kind of broadly conceived. And that is tremendous. And nobody is actually thinking through, I think, in a genuinely honest way about what that means for world politics.
So I think you're right. And I think the other thing is that Macron, he presents himself as an outsider candidate, as a sort of centrist, but a reformer, someone who's not really part of the political establishment, all of which is nonsense, really, because he's actually the true sort of elite candidate, even more than Fillon is, because he's the most reformist. He's actually represents a desire of a lot of the French elite for a long time to be able to have, instead of an alternation of left and right, and a divided legislature and so on, but a real unity centrist candidate who can carry through the kind of liberalizing reforms. So Macron really is their man. And he still looks like the most likely. You know, if I were to bet today, I'm still going Macron's going to be the next president of France. But that's really under question, because I wonder how much in France today people see him genuinely as a sort of outsider candidate, as a change candidate, or someone who really ends up representing what the French people have kind of rejected over and over again every time neoliberal reforms have been tried to have been introduced, you know?
Yes, I think
that's a good point. And I guess this is kind of one of the main questions that I wanted to ask, which is, it seems like the dominant narrative is that Macron will win. He is the establishment candidate. Perry Anderson called him an antibody of the system, and Laudon called him a spasm of the system. So he's in some ways an establishment candidate, but maybe slightly different in some ways. But is it too simple to basically say that he's going to win? So we don't really need to worry about this. All of the kind of scaremongering that the economists have put forward, for example, is a bit far-fetched.
It's a good question. And I think, I mean, it's precisely the right question to ask, because I mean, so the way I was thinking about it, I think the Sixth Republic effectively is inevitable. By which I mean, so Mélenchon, one of the kind of planks in the Mélenchon platform is the need for a Sixth Republic. So you have this decayed Fifth Republic in France now, which is presidential, the tremendous kind of concentration of power which de Gaulle placed in the presidency, and the common pattern is that you have a presidency of belonging to one party and then a legislature which is divided. That's been the pattern, I think, which has kind of plagued French politics over the last 20, 30 years or so. So I think, I mean, whoever wins, I think the Sixth Republic de facto is inevitable. What I mean by that is to say, like, even if Macron wins, who's the establishment candidate, he comes from no party. He's put together, it's a social movement, which he's manufactured around his individual personality. It's very unclear what he stands for beyond fashionable kind of the fashionable kind of fiscal austerity, social liberalism, mainstream centrism against the extremity of both left and right. So if he wins, he comes, it means that the old party system associated with the Fifth Republic has been destroyed effectively. Even his victory still means that the Fifth Republic has been shown to be, the political structure of the Fifth Republic has been destroyed. So on the other hand, if Marine Le Pen wins, then she withdraws and she follows through on her promise to withdraw France from the euro and from the EU. She has a referendum on EU membership. You have the Fifth Republic effectively withdrawing from its external structure that contains it and which has reconfigured the way in which the French state operates. So again, effectively, you have a new type of state emerging in France. And if Mélenchon wins, he said that he is willing to consider a referendum on EU membership, and he said that he stands for having some kind of constitutional convention which will lead to a new political regime in France and Sixth Republic. So whichever candidate wins, I think the disintegration of the old party system and the disorientation to the French elite and the reshaping of ordinary voters' expectations means that the Fifth Republic is over. The real question then is who is able to actualize the reality of that in the way that's most effective in terms of what's politically possible and desirable.
Just to rewind a little bit, I'm just going to talk a little bit of bullshit about the French national character, but I think it's relevant because
this is going to be really xenophobic.
This is going to get to know.
I'm looking forward to hearing.
No, this is going to be, I have to tell you, I've got a lot of respect for France. Actually, France, I still got this kind of pretty misguided.
Some of my best friends are French.
Yeah. This is what I like about the French. They have this sort of adherence to an idea, to certain principles, which can take their left or the right formulation. But they still have this sort of adherence to a conception of French republicanism. And it maybe makes them assholes because they're kind of a bit difficult, you know, but the thing is that French decline, the fact that France has just sort of become a bit of an ordinary country, you know, they've got McDonald's and big box retailers and like Hollywood films and a worsening education system. It just looks kind of like the rest of the West now. Then you kind of think, well, why are you such assholes? What gives you the right to be so difficult rather than
the French Revolution, the Enlightenment, Descartes?
What they have now is just this sort of parochial sort of arseholery rather than an alternate universalism as opposed to the sort of American empire. That's gone now. What I really like about Jean-Luc Mélenchon is precisely his attempt to sort of refound the Republic, to put it explicitly in terms of a new Sixth Republic. If you compare his campaign now to previous ones of his and other kind of far-left candidates in France, it doesn't really rely on the icons of the left. There's no red flags, all that kind of stuff. It's really trying to surf a left populist wave. I think there's even reference to like Podemos and stuff like that. He puts it very much in Republican language of refounding of a people, of a nation, the new Sixth Republic. It's interesting because it's actually kind of a more sort of imminent critique of France than what you have in Britain, for example, with like Corbyn's moralizing, which isn't really rooted in anything.
I'm glad you raised it because I totally disagree. Like, because I think it's the weakness. It exactly speaks to the weakness of Mélenchon in two respects. I mean, so he wants a Sixth Republic while he wants to renegotiate EU treaties and be disingenuous and muddle-headed. You can't have you will not be able to maintain those two things. And I mean, for a start, I think it should be simply withdrawal from the EU should be the sine qua non of any kind of major project of political reform, if you stand for it. But also I think it's this attempt to cast the widest possible tent and to have the most politically vacuous and expansive slogans of catch-all ideas of the vaguest possible reform and change and transformation, which is the most objectionable thing about the Mélenchon campaign, because it's politically opportunistic and it's dishonest. It's worse than populism. The reason it's worse than populism is because it's self-conscious populism. It's leftist theory which has been, so they very self-consciously modeled their political project. If you read the interview with a supporter, one of Mélenchon's political operatives, which is recently published in Jacobin, it's this very, he describes the political vision in the very self-conscious terms of that they've borrowed from Laclau and Mouffe's idea of populism, and that they've cast their language particularly and their slogans in ways which are specifically designed to capture the widest possible audience and to be as vague and empty signifiers. It's all kind of leftist theory, which is designed to capture as many people as possible. And therefore, it seems to me to be worse than populism because they're deliberately trying to be populist. It's not simply catching on ideas which don't find expression in the political mainstream, with kind of popular ideas, and then trying to translate that into some kind of meaningful political policy or slogan. They're deliberately designing policy to capture the widest possible desire for change and transformation.
I don't disagree with your general sort of characterization of it. And I think it's, I basically agree with that. And I think it's a good thing. I mean, that's basically why I kind of endorse it. I'm not talking about specific policies. I don't agree with his desire to ditch nuclear power. There's various other policies which I've got questions about one way or the other. Positioning certain, even sort of liberal claims around sort of immigration, for example, or peace or whatever. If you listen to his speech in Marseille, which I'll be honest, brought a bit of a tear to my eye, but I'm a big sob, so whatever. But if you listen to that
speech, you are a big sob.
Yeah, but you know, come on, the tears were running. It was beautiful. I don't know if there's like a subtitled version in English for listeners, but it's really worth looking up. It's great political oratory, at the very least. But I think it's more significant than that because it doesn't. The reason that the left and the center left has lost the war basically on immigration and various other liberal issues, which might be termed humanitarian or whatever, is precisely because it's only done in humanitarian, human rights sort of language about helping the other. There's no sort of self-interested position in it. And Mélenchon's approach is to really position it within a sense of what the people is about as a sort of bearer of civilization. The idea that, you know, for example, we should be proud as a country to welcome these immigrants because to be a sort of a great bearer of civilization. I think that's a lot better way of approaching the question than of saying, well, look at these poor refugees, we should help them. And then people kind of go, yeah, well, what the fuck about us?
Alex, I think you're definitely right that it comes across as striking and unusual that you have a left candidate.
Like, so now that the chair is intervening in favor of a particular position in this debate?
No, I just think that was a good point. I'm allowed to say that.
No, you're not. I didn't read any constitutional document where it says the chair is allowed the chair, to
the, not, you know, the chair's not chairing a debate. It's just someone who vaguely guides it.
You're just allowed, you're just sitting in a
chair. We're only three people. You can't like exclude then one of us from actually like getting in the debate. Otherwise, it's like it's just me and you, Phil. No one wants to listen to just us two.
This sounds all right to me.
if I'd come in with a point in favor of Phil, he would have been like, yeah, great. So the chair agrees with me. So on to the next question.
Well, now you need to give a good point like in favor of me so that it's evenly balanced as a chair.
No, I think what Phil was saying was really it's really eloquent and really nice language. Neat handwriting is basically.
I see. Wow. Okay.
Well, then I won't make my point so strongly that the conception of the people, like an active idea of having immigration as a positive benefit for people rather than just a humanitarian requirement.
Okay, but there are specific policies which I think you could be sympathetic to. So, I mean, openness towards migrants, which is non-humanitarian, his views withdrawing France from NATO, say suggesting that the French should ignore the Stability and Growth Pact, which has been the kind of economic straitjacket for members of the Eurozone. I mean, I think there are specific things in the manifesto and the program which you could agree with. As a political project, which is to say kind of assessed, evaluated more collectively, holistically, I think it's deeply disingenuous. And this idea that that it should, like I say, it's a populism which is self-conscious, which is populism is bad enough to begin with. The other thing we've not talked about is the fact that the legislative elections, none of these candidates, whether Macron or Le Pen, I don't know about Fillon, but whether Macron, Le Pen or Mélenchon win, none of them are going to have sufficient legislative strength in the assembly to carry through the kinds of the extent of the reforms that they want. So you're looking at you're much more likely to have a gridlocked political system emerging. So that has to be kind of borne in mind as to whatever political program the presidency has on offer. And we haven't really spoken about that. My feeling is that if Mélenchon wins, it's going to be Syriza all over again in Greece. Tremendous expectation around Europe for the possibility of democratization of the European Union, reform of its structures, renegotiation of possibilities, which will inevitably fail to deliver. And it will be even more catastrophic and even more devastating to the hopes of the left than anything else that happens if Mélenchon wins.
I think there's I think that's right. He specifically talks about a plan A and a plan B, which has terrible echoes of Varoufakis' good euro sort of program. And there's a thing when it comes to nation states, sort of populist parties talking about Europe, that the more open they seem to various possibilities, the more likely they are to cave in. Right. So if they're hardline, they might cede a little bit. But yeah. If they talk about a plan A and a plan B, you're like, yeah, this is just going to be the plan A. Like, you're just going to go. So his plan A is reform of euro and of Europe to allow kind of a little bit of fiscal loosening and so on.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't work, then they'll withdraw. But because they're not going in with the big threat, it's only kept sort of in the back pocket. You kind of suspect it'll never be enacted. And in that sense, I do agree that it'll be a bit Syriza all over again. The one argument against that is that France, one, the balance of power within the EU may have changed because of Brexit and other developments, and also because France has a lot more weight to throw around. So when it's pushing for reform, it can't just be like, as they said to Varoufakis, listen, mate, you're like you're representing like the poorest member of the Eurozone, just like fuck off, yeah?
So you're absolutely right. This kind of plan A, plan B, which Mélenchon has put forward, that if they don't get plan A, they'll fall back on the on a referendum to leave the European Union, is, I think, all it means is effectively that they've given themselves much more political room to maneuver in which to offer some crappy compromise position to the French electorate and to say that, well, you know, here we've negotiated some extra wiggle room and therefore we're not going to have to go to plan B.
So we've talked about Mélenchon, we've talked about Le Pen a little bit, probably as much as we need to, or maybe. But I had a question about Hamon. So what happened to him?
Just one interesting little tidbit that I read. It was an Icelandic social democrat bemoaning that I think they achieved something like 6% of the vote in the Netherlands. The Labour Party there achieved 6% of the vote, kind of suggesting is 6% the future for the centre left, and kind of going on with the various pieties about kind of being the party of internationalism and blah, 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 and how to kind of refound social democracy and win the trust of voters, blah, blah, blah. Relatively self-aware, but also relatively self-deluding. But the interesting thing about that 6% figure is that if I were to put a wager on, I'm thinking, yeah, that's what Hamon finishes with as well, about 6%. He's pulling at about 8%, and kind of one suspects he'll do worse than that.
6% sounds, it's a great, 6%. That's the future of social democracy, 6%. There you go.
Do we want to
for a social democratic party?
Say that again?
I said it's strong for a beer, but not particularly strong for a social democratic party.
That's right. Yeah, you can't really call it weak beer then, unfortunately.
No, exactly.
Yeah,
when it gets down to 3%, which it inevitably will, then you can...
Weak wine, weak spirit, weak whiskey.
That's not really an expression, though. Do you want to discuss a little bit about what we think will happen so we can do this a little bit more, kind of neutrally and scientifically, like kind of Vox style?
We could just so that we're all proved wrong.
Yeah, let's do it.
That's a great way to instantaneously date this recording, pretty massively. So, Alex, what are your predictions? What do you think is going to happen? And really, just put your balls on the line here.
Okay, so one little observation is that the core support of the two right candidates, of Fillon and Le Pen, is very solid. And I even think that some of Fillon's support might be a bit understated because he's obviously been hit massively by these corruption allegations, but, of employing his wife and so on. in some bullshit role. But the thing is, I suspect that there probably will still be a lot of voters who will still go to the polls for him based on allegiance to the kind of Gaullist parties and Les Républicains and so on, irrespective of Fillon. I suspect Fillon will do a little bit better than expected. He's polling around like kind of 19%, so it's all very tight. The interesting thing is that all the candidates on the center and the left, which is to say Hamon, Macron, and Mélenchon, all have much lower rates of sort of certainty from voters, right? It's around sort of 60%. So there's a lot of room for maneuver there. Mélenchon actually is the favored, this kind of favored second candidate, if you look across the board. He even would make up some numbers from Fillon and even Le Pen supporters. Actually, I should say Le Pen and even some Fillon supporters as a sort of second choice candidate. So he has the one who has the most to gain from the sloughing off of support from Hamon, which is possible, and also from Macron. So I think that's like really, really interesting how that'll play out. If you're asking me for a prediction, I'm going to be like pretty obvious and just say it's going to be Macron versus Le Pen in the second round, but it's going to be tight.
So what, Macron on penalties? What's going to happen?
Macron, it's going to be like a pretty solid extra time victory for Macron. He's going to like score 3 goals. It's going to be like that Champions League final between Real Madrid and Atletico again.
I think I would. So to add to what Alex has said, I think not to underestimate Fillon supporters, because I imagine they're probably, I think it's fair to say, they're probably more predictable in terms of turning out of the polls than the people who say that they'll vote for Macron or Mélenchon. That said, I think that the second round polls at this stage probably also are less, they all look much more decisive than the first round polls, which are all within, you know, for the 4 front runners, they're all within the margin of error. The second round seem much more decisive. And my guess is that those second round predictions will look very different once the first round is over, that they will look and that we shouldn't build our views of who would win. I mean, for instance, I think there'll probably be a shy National Front effect with these polls. I think a lot of small town Catholic, rural, right of centre and right wing voters will vote for Le Pen, say, over Mélenchon if it came to a Mélenchon Le Pen second round runoff. So that I think Le Pen support, just as like Alex said, that Fillon supporters can be counted on to turn up at the ballot box. I think Le Pen could capture a lot of right wing Catholic rural votes that would strengthen her position in any runoff in which she is, if she is up against Macron or against Mélenchon. So yeah, I mean, I think the baseline I would like to stick to is the more holistic prediction, which is to say the Fifth Republic is over, whatever happens.
Okay, so you're basically saying Le Pen to win, it's going to be the start of submission, that Welbeck.
No. In the Welbeck book, yeah. But I mean, I don't want to get stuck in who's going to win, because I think the more holistic perspective is warranted in this, in the kind of mania for specific point predictions and forecasting in political discussion at the moment.
Ah, but come on, it's like, this is like the political version of sports. You gotta get in with your.
Yeah, I mean, here. Well, but then I would tack. You know, what will I do? I'll tack towards whatever you've said. I think it'll probably will be a Macron Le Pen.
You know the great thing about talking about electoral outcomes and possibilities and talking about different percentages is that you can divest yourself of any worries and any hard thinking about what different things imply and what they mean and
which
what
is
the
exactly,
outcomes are.
Which is exactly
just,
why
you can just talk bullshit about what you think is
exactly
going to happen.
Exactly why
look at
I want to say. Exactly why I want to avoid it.
I think Mélenchon's going to win. I'm just going to go out there and say.
I think it'd be better for the Mélenchon to be in opposition, for the far left to be in opposition, than it would be for them to win, because they will thrive in opposition without the burden of political responsibility and leadership, which the left has evidently struggled with throughout the Eurozone crisis, but generally, historically, they've struggled with. And so if you really want Mélenchon to thrive, you should hope that he doesn't win, because if he wins, it will be a disaster for the left on the European level. It will be Syriza all over again on a much more disastrous scale.
Okay, yeah, so this is
I think that maybe is a good point, but I think that it for me at least, it mirrors in some ways the Brexit arguments, just this absolute certainty that Macron's going to win, but actually there's this sort of anti-establishment. There's two anti-establishment candidates, and France is unwilling to be submissive. So I think there's a very real possibility that one of those two will win, and I think it's pretty unconscionable that Le Pen could end up winning.
Let's just be clear about the anti-establishment thing, because actually, other than Fillon, they're all in a way anti-establishment candidates, at least in terms of their positioning. Yeah. Not de facto, because of course, as we said, Macron is the elite's favorite candidate. He is the kind the of banker. The neoliberalism redux banker kind of candidate, right? But they're all the change candidates. You know, it's only Fillon who you can say is, you know, he's kind of conservative, Catholic, right wing, kind of supposedly free marketeer. But you know,
that's Gaullist. Well, a Gaullist, I think.
You know, yeah. Can I just one observation actually about, because I agree with Phil that there might be an argument that the left, as in opposition, would be a more productive moment for the left in France and in Europe than a Mélenchon presidency.
To be clear, that's a criticism of Mélenchon. I mean, to say because the left is unable to bear the burden of political power. So, I mean, it's not to say that it's something that I desire either way. I don't support, I'm not excited about the prospect of a Mélenchon victory. But I think if you're concerned about the prospects of left in Europe, you'd do better to hope for a Mélenchon defeat, because a Mélenchon victory will be much more destructive to the left in the short term.
Okay, I think we'll have to discuss that at another time, but just an observation related to that is that I think who becomes the sort of legitimate opposition to whoever wins, right? It's kind of interesting. Yeah. So I think one, we haven't discussed the possibility of a Fillon-Le Pen runoff, which was the kind of what we were looking at a little while ago. I mean, I think 6 months ago, that seemed the most likely outcome, and that seemed really disastrous. It looked like another kind of 2002 French presidential runoff all over again, but under much kind of more stressed circumstances that we have today. But I think that's still a possibility. And in that situation, a strong showing for Mélenchon would, I think, give credence to the idea that the kind of legitimate opposition to austerity, to the EU and so on, is the left and not Le Pen, right? And I think this is still very much to be fought for, right?
What is the
legitimate anti-establishment position? Is it the far right or is it the left, right? And I think how the exact election plays out and how the respective candidates do does impact how that comes to be seen, right? It's not just a numbers game that we can kind of ignore.
What you said, I think, I mean, that the fact that they're all anti-establishment, I think, is a really important point, because, you know, Macron is running without a party, right? I mean, he's running on this kind of made up, this utterly kind of vacuous En Marche.
On the movement. Go.
Yeah, which, I mean, it's as utterly kind of empty as Berlusconi's Forza Italia. So, I mean, bearing in mind that it has the kind of, it's technocratic populism, it embodies that kind of sense of political, this kind of empty vehicle for political renewal, which is at the same time aiming for kind of this managerial vision of economically efficient politics and reform, stripping down the civil service, re-energizing the private sector, this kind of vision. So, I mean, they're all, like you say, the front runners are anti-establishment candidates. And I think that reinforces the point about the end of the Fifth Republic, that this is whoever wins, it's the last election of the Fifth Republic, presidential election of the Fifth Republic.
Okay.
Cool, good job.
So are we ready to move on to talking about Westworld? Or do we want to keep talking about this? I haven't got any more questions. Those are the things I want to talk
you
about.
Have to get, you gave your shot, didn't you? You said what you thought was happening.
I did. I said Mélenchon. I stand by that.
Mélenchon to win?
Yeah.
Are you just saying that? Do you really think that?
I think it might happen. I have a. So we had a. You can obviously, Alex, you can edit this out. We had a sweepstake at work where you had to estimate the Brexit result, and I guess 52-48.
No way.
So, yeah, I've been reading my tea leaves. I've been I don't know, just looking at the sheep intestines. So, I'm feeling it.
I think that's a good place to leave it. I mean, I think we'll round up the French elections either after the first round or after the second round, possibly with guests who know stuff about France specifically, which would be good.